Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been 2 weeks since Superstorm Sandy plowed through the Northeast, killing 120 people in 10 states and nearly 70 in the Caribbean. The storm knocked out power for 8.5 million people, and as of last week, tens of thousands of people in New York and New Jersey remained without power. In New York City, half of those still living without heat, hot water, or electricity live in public housing projects. Many grassroots community groups are still helping people in communities ravaged by the storm, with a focus on the older and disabled populations. Many are still stranded 15 stories high. Occupy Sandy and New York Communities for Change have allied with local organizations to set up ad hoc aid distribution centers in churches, community centers, and school gymnasiums. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the latest in New Jersey and New York. Also, what lessons can we learn from Hurricane Sandy? What are the possibilities of something similar happening in California? Of course, we've got earthquakes here. And unlike what happened in New York and New Jersey, chances are we're not going to get any notice. So what are the most susceptible areas? Where has the government been successful? What about FEMA? Where have they not? And what can we learn? Olivia Lehrer is an organizer with the New York Communities for Change. That's a coalition of working families in low and moderate income communities fighting for social and economic justice throughout New York State. Hi, Olivia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. We're also joined by Jeffrey Mount, professor of geology, director emeritus, and founding director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. And he joins us from Davis. Hi, Professor Mount. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. And joining us in studio is Anna Marie Jones, executive director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. They provide emergency preparedness and disaster response resources for nonprofits and community agencies serving our most vulnerable residents. Hi, Anna Marie. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Olivia, why don't we start off with you? You are in New York. Please give us an update of what's happening, because even just about 5 days ago, there were still stories about people who are still in dire need of the basics. Mainly, we're talking about heat and power. What is the situation like today?
Right. I mean, we still have thousands of people in areas like Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, who are now going on 3 weeks without any power, any heat in their homes. Wow. So the situation is still, it's still pretty dire out there. We had a pretty bad snowstorm the week after the storm that set everything back even further. But, you know, it's pretty cold out here, and, you know, going without heat for a long time is really, even in places where they have power, like Red Hook now mostly has power, but they still have no heat. So, I mean, a lot of boilers were in the basements of apartment buildings and have just been completely destroyed, and it's been really, you know, really a challenge to get people back to normal.
And when you say it's cold, can you describe that for us? Because our version of cold is like high 50s, to be honest with you. How cold is it there?
We've been in the mid 40s. You know, we've had a couple of nice days in the 60s, but mostly it's been hovering around like, you know, low 40s, mid 40s, and, you know, low 50s at the high of the day. So.
And so what is your overall assessment of the role that FEMA played and the state governments?
I mean, it's hard to get a read on exactly, you know, on what their strategy was going into it, because, you know, it seems like, you know, FEMA, the Red Cross, everyone was sort of talking about this as a success story. But when we started, and let me just maybe give a little background about what NYCC, how we got involved with this. So we're a community organizing group. We organize in low and middle income communities, and we have a chapter on Far Rockaway, which is how we sort of first got involved in this work. We, you know, the storm happened, and we all kind of checked in with each other and found out who, you know, that everyone was okay and had made it through. And, you know, a lot of our organizers live in Red Hook, in Coney Island, in areas that were very affected by the storm. So we started calling our members to make sure that everyone had made it through okay and find out what people needed, and we found that our members on Far Rockaway were not getting any emergency services. And this is, you know, the day after the storm. So, you know, once we were all able to kind of get our power back and get our phones charged and start talking to people. And so the immediately after we found out that our members on Far Rockaway weren't getting what they needed, we started meeting with the local councilman, James Sanders, and with community groups on the ground in Far Rockaway to find out how we could really start running a distribution program, and then started reaching out to people about getting supplies and donations. So that was sort of the first week. It was really just, you know, community groups like ours, the Rockaway Youth Task Force, and you know, organizers involved with Occupy Sandy, kind of on the ground doing any kind of relief work. You know, after that, we slowly started, you know, seeing other folks trickle in, and we've been in contact with the Red Cross and connecting them with our on-the-ground distribution centers and the churches that we've been working with. You know, but for the first week, it was really, you know, just people who were completely shocked that, you know, we found our members were on their last bottle of water. Mm-hmm. No one thought that we would be, you know, in this situation for this long of a time.
Right. In fact, I read articles about members of Occupy Sandy just going into buildings, knocking on doors, making sure people were okay, and then just offering basics like bottled water and then finding out what else they needed. Professor Mount, what are your overall thoughts, just based on what you've read and what you've seen from your perspective in Davis about relief efforts in Sandy? What stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I have to tell you that Hurricane Katrina continues to be the benchmark for all of us who follow natural disasters, and of course that was the nadir of responses to natural disasters. So, well, the people subjected to Superstorm Sandy may have issues with the rate of recovery. Again, we always use it with the yardstick of Katrina, and the response was so much better, orders of magnitude better than the response to Katrina. Given the size of this storm, personally, when I look at it, and the density of population there, and actually the geographic location where the storm hit, and the very nature of it itself, I'm frankly not surprised that we still have some areas that are not getting full relief, and some areas may never recover, which is a whole separate conversation. That said, we can always do a better job, and this was interesting to listen to the firsthand account, because frankly the news media is missing this, which is probably a subject for us to also discuss, is the disaster memory half-life problem. When the media tends to lose interest in these issues with time, people tend to suffer because there's not the pressure that's kept on to do something. So I'm glad you're actually bringing this up on your show.
Yes. And in fact, I've read a number of firsthand accounts from members of Occupy Sandy who, you know, maybe live in Manhattan and have done a lot of relief work in Red Hook. And some people say they were shocked by what they found. And they went to the very end of the subway lines. And that's where a lot of the need is greatest. And Anna Marie, what's your overall assessment of relief, and what does it reveal to you?
That we are a slow learning nation when it comes to all things to do with disaster and disaster response. I'm a New Yorker, and I've been in disaster management for years, and I'm not surprised by absolutely any of it. I would agree that Hurricane Katrina is still a very low point, but we still haven't learned the very basic lessons that we learned here after the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. We knew that vulnerable communities would be most adversely impacted, and we knew that responders would have the hardest time reaching them. But we still, when you think about what we do for them for preparedness and planning, we are still basically assuming that, well, eventually it's all going to work. And no, it won't. They actually need completely different interventions in our poorest communities and our hardest to reach communities. And until funders and until the media can wrap themselves around that, we will continue doing more of the same thing. I figure, and I'm a New Yorker, so I'm kind of passionate about what happens to my city. I figure at some point we're still going to hear someone roll out, oh, here's our new planning initiative, and it's all going to be about you need to have a kit and you need to have a plan. And no matter how many times that fails, we continue to do it. So I think there's a lot of politics behind it. There's a lot of fear of pushing against certain traditions, but we need to do it.
So what changes would you like to see specifically in vulnerable neighborhoods?
One, I would want the grassiest of grassroots organizing groups to be empowered rather than making this a disaster initiative. There is an incredibly short interest span for disasters, and only a tiny percentage of the public is actually willing to talk about disasters ongoingly. So to have grassroots groups whose mission, whose muscles, whose mindset is about community building and community organizing, those groups need to be at the forefront of this, as opposed to thinking that we're going to push Red Cross and FEMA and fire down into the roots of those communities. It's just a completely different mindset.
And that's Anna Marie Jones. She's executive director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. They are located in the Bay Area. Olivia Lehrer is an organizer in New York with New York Communities for Change. And Olivia, what has the relationship been like between your group, members of Occupy Sandy, and, say, the Bloomberg administration, for example?
Between NYCC and Occupy Sandy, you know, we have always, you know, we work on similar kind of issues overall. That, you know, we've collaborated a lot with Occupy in the past, so the lines of communication in that regard have been pretty open, and we've been doing a lot to communicate and try and collaborate where we can. I can't say that we have had any contact really with the mayor's office, you know, outside of maybe you know, running into folks on the ground, and it hasn't been a huge part of what we've been doing. You know, we've just been getting supplies out to people who need them, knocking on doors, finding out what people need. I'm hoping that moving forward, and I think we're starting to see that moving forward, when we start talking about long-term collaborations, that those channels of communication will be more open. But I just wanted to echo something that was said earlier about the way that low-income communities are impacted by these kind of storms. I know a lot of people in the Rockaways didn't feel like they could leave their homes because they were worried about being looted during the storm, and, you know, and coming back and finding their homes to be robbed. And I know some people in areas in Long Island who, you know, did leave and had everything stolen out of their homes. So, you know, it's just a different situation when you don't have the expectation that there will be adequate security to abandon your home and to go stay in a shelter. You know, most of these people couldn't stay in, you know, when they did leave and go to a shelter, they left and stayed in a city shelter. So they were, you know, sleeping on a cot with tons of people. And, you know, it's not like it's always going to impact low-income communities more because they aren't able to go stay in a hotel, or they maybe don't have as many relatives, and that mobility issue is something that I think really needs to be looked at, and you know, feeling like you can leave your home and that it'll be safe.
Right.
At least, you know, not only dealing with the elements, but dealing with, you know, making sure that there's enough presence of people protecting your belongings.
Right, and that is Olivia Lehrer, organizer with New York Communities for Change. We're also joined by Jeffrey Mount, professor of geology and founding director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Anna Marie Jones, executive director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. And today we are talking about Superstorm Sandy, what we can learn from relief efforts, the good, the bad, and the ugly. What are your thoughts on, you know, what's your overall perspective based on what you've read and seen in terms of how FEMA responded, how the state government, the local government, and how can we apply that to what we face here in California? And we'll talk about what we might be facing in the future. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you've ever been involved in any relief efforts, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and what lessons have you learned? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Professor Mount, we obviously face earthquakes here, and what's different is that people were notified that something was coming and to prepare. Obviously, with an earthquake, we can't be notified. Can you talk about how significant that is and how that really does affect relief efforts?
Right, and the problem with earthquakes is not only are they a very short-lived phenomena, happen fast, and they're over with in a hurry, but we tend to forget them. I'm pleased that Anna Marie brought up the Loma Prieta quake and how many Bay Area residents, when you talk to them today, who went through the Loma Prieta quake, even think about it once a month. So that's one of the big problems with earthquakes in particular, is they come so rarely that it's very, very hard to convince people to plan for them. Now, I'm going to give you some positive news in that regard. For some years now, the U.S. Geological Survey has been spearheading a thing called the Great California Shakeout. This is probably the most effective organizational effort I've seen in recent memory on trying to deal with earthquakes. And what they do is every year they have a date, and it was October 18th of this year, and everybody, and they try to get as many as 10 to 12 million people involved in that event, and basically they practice for the big earthquake that's going to come. It's not a matter of if, it's just when. And now, this is going to fall very far short of addressing the issues that are being raised in this conversation here, which really focuses on a social justice question that natural disasters tend to fall hardest on the poor and the disenfranchised. But yet, I will tell you, in all my years of working in the disaster business, this is as positive an effort as I've seen, and in this case, it's run out of a research organization in the U.S. Geological Survey who's been pushing this. Now, that said, there is no way you can earthquake-proof yourself. You basically have to clean up afterwards and deal with the disaster. And it's having the assets in place and having the coordination in place and having the ability to hang in there for the long term, because it takes, some of these local communities, it takes a very, very long time to recover from an earthquake. So mostly we're talking about emergency response here, but that emergency response work, as you have already heard, has to be closely coupled with a recovery program. And what kind of recovery program? On the recovery side is, I think, probably where we're weakest these days in terms of planning in California, but we're getting better and better on our emergency response work.
Anna Marie?
I would agree that the shakeout is successful in terms of raising awareness about the need to plan for earthquakes. But survey after survey still shows that we remain grossly unprepared. And when we look at CARD, what we have learned just by staying focused on this preparedness and planning question with vulnerable communities over the last 23 years is there is no amount of earthquake threat, there's no amount of terrorism threat. You could throw anything at these vulnerable communities, and it's not going to force them to prioritize planning over what's going on in their everyday lives. If you go to the poorest communities, how in the world can we continue to tell them that what they really should be worried about is that sometime in the next 30 years there could be an earthquake, when they're sitting there not having food for tomorrow night's dinner, not being able to put shoes on their kids' feet? So it is a framework of planning for emergencies that is very much an upper middle class American way of viewing it. If we want our most marginalized, most vulnerable communities to address being ready and having the ability to respond, recover, and do all of those things, the entire conversation needs to be framed differently. And for me, I'm looking at what we have found to be successful. One, it's a prepare to prosper approach. It is going into those communities and helping them to see the skill sets they can build that will allow them to mobilize assets to accomplish whatever it is they want to accomplish. If they've got urban blight going on in their neighborhood, awesome. Then let's look at community organizing and mobilizing to address that need. Once you've built a community that steps up for each other, they can communicate powerfully, they can mobilize their assets, an earthquake is just one of the things they can use those skill sets for. But framing this entire conversation around the horrible and the terrible and the catastrophic really eliminates most of the vulnerable communities from anything more than the most superficial level of participation.
And Olivia, based on what you've seen in the vulnerable communities in New York and New Jersey, what advice would you give to California officials as we prepare for whether it's an earthquake or a storm?
Sure. I think exactly what Anna Maria has been saying has sort of been our role in this relief effort. I mean, we, like I said, we predominantly organize around issues of social justice and economic justice, like housing, education, and so when when we established ourselves in the Rockaways as a group that was fighting for mostly around housing issues. And then when the storm happened, we were there. We knew the people. You know, we had the connections, and were able to mobilize a larger citywide network around that. I think what would have really been helpful is if we were brought into the conversation and given support. We've been relying on donations and had a wonderful response, and people have been amazingly generous. But there was a huge amount of money raised off of this storm, and then came time for the plan of where do we get these resources? How do we reach out to people? We didn't start hearing from people until 10, 15 days after the storm. So I think that the most important thing is, work with the people who are already in the community, who are organizing in the community around all issues. And, that it's a little bit more challenging because there's political alliances. When you fight for the issues that represent working families, it's inherently political, and it's not as sort of across the board positive as, we think that people want storm relief. People want preparedness, but when you mix it in with all of these issues of social justice and of inequality, then it gets politicized in a way that I think is less comfortable for people. So I think it's really important to kind of put that aside and figure out who's on the ground and make sure that communities are organized, and not just for the short-term things like getting food and water and getting their heat back on, but also long-term situations and disaster capitalism. Really, that's a huge flag for us, and a huge lesson that we're trying to learn from Katrina is that we need to be organized now, and we need to make sure that communities have a voice in what happens to their neighborhoods after the media attention is gone, and after FEMA is gone, and after the Red Cross isn't there. Making sure that we have the ability to give a voice to the residents of that community, make sure that they're not, having their homes bulldozed and replaced with luxury condos, but that the people who live there can come back and they're actually a part of that process.
And I would just add that there's a level of politics that few people ever want to talk about, and one of those big, big issues is that there is this bizarre relationship between disaster response and the dollars and planning. If you look at how much money is raised for disaster response, the immediate critical response, that can be billions of dollars. But you only raise billions of dollars when you see extreme abject suffering. So when you have disaster response agencies taking tons of money to do a low level of preparedness, and then they're going to make billions, absolutely billions, for there being nothing in place, we have to start looking at that. We have to start separating this concept of who is doing the organizing and preparing versus who benefits from us not having an appropriate response. It's billions of dollars for response and pennies for preparedness, and it has never worked.
And Sherry Wolf, who's been doing relief efforts in Red Hook, asks a question on the socialist worker. She says, people must ask, why in such a wealthy city is urgent relief being left to individual initiatives days after the storm? She says, intrepid volunteers with full backpacks and a few days off work is not a sustainable plan to deal with the scale of this crisis. And I'd love to address this issue right after the break. What role should these groups play versus what role the state and the federal government should play? And today we are talking about Superstorm Sandy. What can we learn? What has actually worked? What has not worked? And what can we apply here when we've got, say, an earthquake or a storm? We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. To take part in today's conversation, you can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'll always like to hear new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Deanne McEwen, president of the California Nurses Association. We'll talk about their organizing efforts. They've been pushing hard for the global financial transaction tax, also known as the Robin Hood tax. They're also striking up and down the state of California for patient care and better contracts. So how does the nurses union use its political power to influence policy? And unlike so many other groups, they've managed to stay independent of political parties. So how have they done it? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what we can learn from relief efforts in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy. Unfortunately, tens of thousands of people, mostly in low-income communities, are still waiting for the basics, namely heat and power. There have been so many stories about how Occupy Sandy and other groups have really stepped up to fill the void, to knock on doors, to find out if people are okay, to bring them basics like water. And so we're talking about what we can learn from government efforts, from FEMA, from the local government, federal government, and how we can apply that to what we will be facing here in California. And we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We did invite FEMA to join us, but they did not respond to our invitation. And today we're joined by Olivia Lehrer, organizer with New York Communities for Change, a coalition of working families in low and moderate income communities fighting for social justice throughout New York State. Jeffrey Mount, professor of geology and founding director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Anna Marie Jones is executive director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. They provide emergency preparedness and disaster response resources. And let's hear from Thor, who spent 33 years in the Hayward Fire Department, and he also worked in public education. Hi, Thor. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Thanks. Good. And what's your last name?
Paulson.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for calling in. So we've been talking about what we can learn from relief efforts. And based on what you've seen with Superstorm Sandy and even Hurricane Katrina, what can we learn from those efforts and apply to what we might face here in California?
Yes, apparently, you know, we just don't seem to learn. We have a tendency to have catastrophic events over and over. And we still end up with the same problems. So obviously what we've been doing has not been functioning. You know, we've been teaching here in the Bay Area on the East Bay about disaster preparedness for the last many years, about the fault that runs right down through Hayward. Of course, out here we don't have the hurricane problems that we do on the East Coast, but we've been continually trying to prepare people, and it just doesn't seem to work well. We still are left with many groups, usually low English learning, low income families who just are not fully prepared. And it always takes a long time, too, for the government to really kick in to make things work in these disasters. Now, when you talk about what needs to be learned from this, we need to learn from our mistakes, first of all. You know, we have disasters every year in this country, some horrifically large, some are on a smaller scale, and it always takes a long time before we can get the resources needed into those areas.
And why is that exactly?
I don't know if it's just the entire structure of the states and the federal government, but I know that things are getting better. They don't seem to be getting better, though, on the same pace as we have, you know, catastrophic events. So I'm not sure why it's taking such a long time. Why does it take hundreds and hundreds of years for us to realize here in the United States that we are not exempt from catastrophes? I think one of the issues is that people are so busy in their lives, they forget that you live in an earthquake zone. They forget they live in a hurricane zone. And they just don't, or they take it for granted. A tornado belt, for instance.
So you've been doing this for decades. What changes would you like to make? I mean, if you had the ear, and I'm sure you do, of government officials in California, what would you tell them?
Well, certainly we've tried many different things. The things that don't work are the horrific pictures of people in agony going through the actual disaster. The scare tactics that we've tried for decades and decades have not worked. They have not worked well. They have scared people away from preparing. They've scared people away from actually dealing with what could happen in their neighborhood or their region.
Are these like public service announcements?
Correct.
Okay.
Public service announcements, photographs of people, going through torment during disasters. We found that those do not work. And what we're trying to do, it's almost like a grassroots effort here, trying to get the government and governments to realize that these photos depicting people in very sad situations do not get people to prepare. We tried taking a better realistic approach here in Hayward in the last 5 years by trying to let people know in a fun way that you can do this cheaply, you can do it on budget, and still have everything that you need. And that doesn't go for all people. You still have the low language learners. You still have the groups that are very difficult to get a hold of, maybe because they're documented or undocumented. They don't want to be involved with local government. So that's also an issue that we deal with.
And so what would work in vulnerable populations?
Well, certainly we need to be much more diverse at the top. We need to have Spanish speakers, Chinese speakers that go out and actually speak with these individual groups. Now, we've been doing that here in Hayward for years with using translators. It is somewhat cumbersome because obviously you can't find professionals that speak all these different languages. So you need to use interpreters. But there's also, different agencies out there that have groups of individuals who need specific things. Maybe, people that are hard of hearing, people that are blind and have no idea what you're showing them as to what they need. Mm-hmm. So there is specific groups that need specific guidance and help. Unfortunately, city governments, local states, and regions are not prepared to deal with these groups directly. And here in Hayward, we've been trying to do a direct outreach to those groups specifically to try to get these people in groups that are much smaller than the average, pockets of the city. To be more prepared.
Yeah, and Thor, it was just so devastating to read about people in New York who live in high rises, especially older people, people with disabilities. I mean, there were instances of volunteers finding people who died because they did not have a way out. The elevators were not working. People were in wheelchairs. So it revealed a lot about what we are facing.
You have to look at overall. Some of the smaller events, maybe a heat wave that lasts 2 days, can kill many people. And those that you just spoke of, who are maybe trapped, they are older, they don't have the outreach that maybe the typical person does. They don't have family members checking on them constantly. The United States is one of the largest, if not the most giving nation in the world on this planet. We have a tendency to open up our pockets for countries that are thousands and thousands of miles away from us. But yet when we have catastrophes in our own backyard, sometimes we are the last ones to be able to get help to these people quickly. It can't all be solved with money. You can't just take a handful of money and throw it at the problem.
Yeah.
You need to really have a diverse amount of people, workers, that can get out there, have contacts with all these people who need assistance before the disaster occurs. And of course, this is a very large a large problem in the United States. You just can't keep track of everybody. And of course, not everybody, including some of the seniors and elderly, want people to help them. They come from a proud time in their lives where they feel they can do everything on their own and continue to work that way. So, it's not necessarily a money issue, but it's an issue that the cities and states and the federal government must deal with and learn that we need to start helping each other and keeping track of each other a lot better. And I don't mean that by the government keeping track of you. I mean that by maybe your neighbor or a neighbor's neighbor keeping track of you, people that you know and that you can count on in a disaster.
Well, Thor, thank you so much for calling in. Really good points. And it's very fascinating also to hear just about how the scare tactics do not work. So thank you so much for calling in. That is Thor Poulsen. He spent 33 years in the Hayward Fire Department, and he also spent many, many years trying to educate the public about this. And Anna Marie, you wanted to respond to what Thor was saying.
Yes, yeah, you just heard why Thor is one of my favorite emergency managers in Alameda County. And actually, Thor was one of the people we had read one of the papers we wrote all about those images and the threats and all of that. I would say that it's not entirely a money issue, but there is a huge money issue involved here. We put billions of dollars into things we know will not work. The ever-expanding brochures, taking brochures and putting them on websites, and basically deciding that that standardized message just has to get further into the community. If that preparedness message actually worked, what you'd see is at least the English-speaking middle-class people would be prepared, but they're not either. So it has not worked. And I come from an advertising and marketing background, and the truth is we have spent billions branding emergency management agencies that they are the ones that understand this topic and they're the ones who will rescue you and 3 to 5 minute response time and all of that. That's branding. That is not preparedness education. That is not empowerment. That is not community organizing. So if you want to start changing this dynamic and having our poorest, hardest to reach communities be part of this, one, it wouldn't be an emergency management effort, and two, it certainly wouldn't be flown under the banner of you're doing this, otherwise you're going to die. Those preparedness messages that have the floating dead bodies and the collapsed houses, it's not just that they don't work. They're actually extremely harmful. It tells people a very negative story about themselves, their community, their futures. So if we want people to actually step up, we have to frame this in a way that accepts who they are, where they are, empowers them to take even the tiniest step forward. We should be focusing on communication rather than how much stuff can you buy and store in your house. We are not connected profoundly into the roots of our community. I don't care how many go kits you pass out. That is not going to be the answer. And we keep doing that. Millions of dollars to pass out go kits. And in the poorest communities, what you will see is the next day, sometimes 2 days later, they've opened up those bags, taken out the stuff that they could use right away, sold some of the other stuff, because that's what happens when you're poor. That's just the way it is. It is not the middle class conversation we keep spending billions of dollars pushing out to the public.
And these go kits, what are you talking about, like flashlights and whistles and things?
And I am a passionate believer we should have those things. As you know, I don't give out brochures. I tend to give people whistles and real tools.
I still have the whistle you gave me from the last show on my keychain.
Thank you. And those things are important. They are not the thing that's going to get people what they need. It's not going to help them be educated. If I could control the world, and certainly I would like to in this arena, I would be organizing those communities so that we could actually reach them, even with a simple message. Can we get a simple message back from them? That alone would change the dynamic. If we could actually reach people, oh my goodness, how different we could get the information out, how differently everything would occur.
And Professor Mount, what would you add to that? And what else should we be concerned about? Because we often talk about earthquakes in California, but what about storms?
I'm afraid that Anna Marie wouldn't like what I'd say, which is, you know, boo, I'm going to scare you now. It isn't earthquakes. Earthquakes are one aspect of it, and if you live in the Bay Area, that's what you tend to focus on in Southern California. But we know now that we've had historic weather systems, which are immense. In fact, 1861, 1862, we had a storm which was so big that we're estimating now that the damage would have dwarfed the amount of damage we saw either in Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina. So this isn't just earthquakes. The largest evacuation events in the history of California have been fire and floods, for example. So we are a sort of a natural disaster epicenter, which is a bad pun. So really, it's a disaster. Preparedness is important. But I want to harken back to one of the things that the earlier caller talked about. When my colleagues from around the world come to visit the United States, and particularly the Dutch, who I work with on flood control issues, they're always stunned that we spend so much money on disaster relief and disaster preparedness and so little money on mitigation. That is, how to avoid the problem in the first place. And this, I just think you can't separate these in your discussion, that for these disenfranchised communities, for these poor communities, you know, where are you on the front end of this disaster, which is probably ultimately more important than you are in the back end of this disaster. Because in the fog of war, which is disaster response, they're all different. There's different responses into all of them, and Anne Marie certainly knows this better than anybody, I suspect. But really, a pound of prevention, a penny of prevention in this case, is hugely important. And unfortunately, we don't talk much about that these days.
And that is Jeffrey Mount, Professor of Geology, Director Emeritus, and Founding Director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Anna Marie Jones is Executive Director of CARD, Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. And Olivia Lehrer is an organizer with New York Communities for Change. And we are talking today about what we can learn from relief efforts from Superstorm Sandy, even Hurricane Katrina. And if there's anything happening in your area that is different from what you've been hearing on today's show, maybe a government official, maybe you feel like they actually get it and they're taking different approaches to disasters, upcoming disasters in California. We'd love to hear from you if you work in this field, what actually works, what doesn't. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you have any overall general questions or concerns about this, because yes, earthquakes get most of the attention, but as Professor Mount said, there's a lot more than just earthquakes in California. 866-798-8255. And we have just about 10 minutes left. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Good morning. I wanted to ask your guest how it panned out in New York with Sandy, particularly for people with disabilities. I know that Rose brought up the elevators being out and people being stranded, which I know well. I use a wheelchair. I'm spinal cord injured. What I'm concerned about earthquake-wise is not so much, well, I am concerned about who I would rely on for assistance. My neighbors are great when it comes to just switching a smoke detector battery or something goes wrong in my house and there's no catastrophe afoot. My guess is that if there were a catastrophe afoot, they would rightly be taking care of their own families first and would not have tops on their list their disabled neighbor next door. And what I'm concerned about is that I personally think it is the government's role to step in and they have the resources to come to the rescue, but I don't know how that played out. As I said, in New York, I also don't know how there were efforts, if there were, to reach people not only with mobility disabilities, but people who I think one of your guests mentioned who are blind and couldn't read the materials or who were deaf and can't hear alerts or what have you. I know I'm signed up with PG&E to get all the alerts first and foremost. I'm worried that would fall through the cracks. I guess what I'm worried about is the privatization of what I think should be public services, be it private companies like the phone company and PG&E or my neighbors, where I really do think it falls to the government to step in.
Right.
And I'm wondering if they know anything about how this played out in New York.
Okay, thank you. Well, Olivia, you're in New York. How would you address Ruthann's concerns, and how did this play out in New York?
I would say absolutely this should be a government role. I mean, I don't think anyone who is on the ground doing relief work feels like this is the ideal situation. We all, I think, feel like it needed to be done by someone. And all of the things that you just sort of listed out are definitely things that we saw. I mean, one of the things that we had our volunteers doing is walking up and down the stairs of high rises and checking on the elderly and checking on people who were unable to leave once the power went out, and making sure that they had what they needed and delivering supplies so that people could get something. I mean, lots of people were down to their last can of soup or their last bottle of water. So, you know, I think it's definitely a concern, and it's definitely something that could be learned, is that, you know, you can't just set up a relief center and expect that people will come and get relief. You have to really do that sort of boots-on-the-ground outreach into communities, go into buildings and, you know, bring things to people who can't leave, and also just let people know that the centers are there. I mean, I don't think people, you know, had a sense of where they could go. Mm-hmm. Until that outreach started happening. So I think it's definitely a huge concern. And I think that it certainly should be not a kind of ragtag group of organizers and activists who are doing this after the storm outreach. So I think we can be helpful in the ways that have already been mentioned. I mean, we have those networks and we have those relationships in the communities that that it seems like it's very difficult to reach for other people. And, you know, working with us to get the information to people in the regular process of our normal communications on all issues that affect their lives, like housing and education, you know, I think that that's definitely something that moving forward would be an excellent effort to engage community groups in the process of getting information to their membership about disasters and about preparedness, and you know, really what you can do. And it's, you know, do you feel like you can leave your home and go to a shelter? And you know, we had our organizers in Far Rockaway giving out information about where the shelters were, and he also was in our lead organizer for Rockaway was also in a flood zone, and all the time that he was doing relief work was also living without power in Red Hook. So, you know, this is definitely something that he had firsthand experience with and could really relate to people on the issues of.
I would say that it is government's responsibility to ensure that these things get done. But I do not believe it is entirely government's responsibility to do certain things. Certain things just have to be done through a shared partnership. And I think it's really incumbent upon proactive and progressive thinking emergency management folks to be brutally honest about their limitations. If you look at how small some emergency management agencies are at the city and county level, you'd understand exactly why so much does not happen. Thor is basically a one-man shop in the city of Hayward, and that says a lot. And he is awesome. We love Thor. He is one of the most progressive. He's really supported us. He believes in our alternative message, but he's a one-man shop for a huge city. So I don't think we will ever have enough emergency managers, and that includes volunteers and all of that, to do all the things that need to be done. But I think government folks should be super proactive about speaking to businesses and funders to make sure that groups like CARD, groups like where Olivia is representing, that we have the resources so that we can do that grass level organizing that is not best done by local government. It just isn't. You've got many people who will never, ever join up if that piece is done through the government. It has to be through communities of choice. It has to be where you're going to hear this. It has to be, you know, your religious organization or your neighborhood group. If you want people with disabilities to be prepared and able to participate in this, it's not going to be because you've expanded the local fire department or your local Red Cross. It'll be because all the service providers you use on a daily basis have supported that and have helped you to build that capacity, and it is then valued inside the organizational cultures. This is nonsense to think that we're going to just keep building our emergency management infrastructure such that when the catastrophic happens, they can swoop in. Nobody can do that. No one. No country has been able to do that. And we invest billions in this, and it has not worked.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ruthann. We have time for one or two more callers. Let's hear from Arlena in Oakland. Hi, Arlena. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to know what the Go Kit is. I think I may be eligible for one, and how we get it.
A Go Kit is really something that you create yourself with many different types of resources. For example, a basic Go Kit would have a change of clothes and some food and some water, and maybe you take medications. So you would have those things so that when a disaster strikes, when an emergency strikes, you can just grab that kit and go. So that's the essence of a Go Kit. Some community groups will periodically put those together and give them out, and I think it's an awesome thing if you have one. The best Go Kits are the ones you make yourself. They would have clothes that fit you and you're comfortable with. They would have food that you can eat and you are comfortable eating. It would have your medication and your prescriptions. It basically means that when there's an emergency, you spend no time in that dithering state of, oh my goodness, there's an emergency, what should I do? You pick up your stuff and you go. And many groups do put out go kits, and I highly recommend the next time someone says there's a disaster preparedness event of some sort, certainly go and you can get this. We just had a big preparedness event in Richmond. Chevron did a great big preparedness event, and kits were offered, Chevron. Bags were offered, and those are the sorts of events that you should show up. You should get all the learning. They're free, and virtually all of us brought supplies. So anyone who attended that event went home with whistles and flashlights and many different things so that they could be more prepared immediately.
All right. Thank you for the call, Arlena. We have just about a minute and a half left. Olivia, final thoughts from you just in terms of tips you would give, what we can learn from what you dealt with or dealing with Superstorm Sandy.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up earlier is I don't think anyone thought that the challenges that we faced would be the ones we actually faced. One of the hardest things for us was finding a way to move donations. You know, people were willing to donate their extra canned food, their extra water, give us money to go out and buy supplies, but you know, the gas shortage was something that we really were in no way prepared for. Hmm. And, you know, finding out ways to move supplies out to the Rockaways and get stuff over to the people who need it. I mean, that's sort of thinking outside of the box and kind of wondering what won't I have access to? You know, there was little cell phone reception in the Rockaways immediately after the storm. So it was hard to even communicate when you had people out there to find out what supplies you needed to send.
Right.
So, you know, all things like that, the way that we rely on technology, we recruited most of our volunteers through social media, and that was amazing. And we, you know, it was sort of the best example of what technology can do to organize a community and to take care of an emergency situation, but also, you know, showed how over-reliant we were on, you know, being able to text someone and find out.
Yeah, it's such a good point. These things we take for granted. And Anna Marie, we'll have to have you back to talk about social media, because I know you say that this has completely changed the game of disaster relief. So thank you so much. Olivia Lehrer, organizer with New York Communities for Change, Jeffrey Mount, professor of geology at UC Davis, and Anna Marie Jones, executive director of CARD, Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, and thanks for your emails and phone calls, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What can we learn from the California Nurses Association's organizing efforts? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Deanne McEwen, president of the California Nurses Association. The nurses are calling for a global financial transaction tax. They're also striking for patient care and better contracts. So how does the union use its power to influence policy? And unlike other groups, the nurses have managed to stay independent of political parties. How have they done it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUST in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Goubert, and I'm the host of a show called The State We're In from Radio Netherlands Worldwide. And each and every week, I talk to people from around the world about the life-changing experiences they've had. And you know what? Hearing their stories may just change your life as well. That's The State We're In, Mondays at 12 noon, here on KALW.
You can hear The State We're In 1 hour from now right here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Local Public Radio. Of course, you can always check us out online at kalw.org. Up next, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Of course, The State We're In at noon. Alternative Radio at 1 o'clock, the BBC's News Hour at 2, and then All Things Considered rounds out the afternoon. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say from the BBC. I'm Ben James. We're covering what's happening in Israel and Gaza.
The weaker side is a terror organization that has its flag is to kill innocent people, and therefore the equation is wrong this time.
That's one Israeli take on what's happening in Gaza and Israel. Others have been using different terminology. So how does the language we use reflect and affect our understanding of what's going on? Is this a war, a conflict, or violence? You're also discussing phrases including targeted killing and siege, terrorist and militant, killed and died. How do you feel about the way the events are being described? Post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay if there are words or phrases you'd like to hear discussed. We'll also talk to people in Israel and Gaza for more eyewitness reports.